Good morning, Santa Fe, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We are streaming on the web at ksfr.org, and the show is podcasting on the internet at santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can listen to the show any time of day thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. You can also subscribe to the show at iTunes. I'd like to welcome anthropologist John Kantner. He's the vice president of the School for Advanced Research, formerly known as the School of American Research, and he's author of the book Ancient Puebloan Southwest, published by Cambridge University Press. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
It's great to have you here. Now, Ancient Puebloan Southwest, that's basically, we're sort of in the middle of the region that you describe in your book.
That's correct.
And human habitation of this region goes back 12,000 years?
At least that long, yes.
What do we know about the very first people here?
Well, the classic understanding of the first people to enter the Southwest would be the classic big game hunters who would be hunting the large megafauna that would have roamed this area back in the time period at the very end of the Pleistocene, when the area would have been covered with lakes and forests, and it was much moister than it is now.
I love the word megafauna.
Yes, megafauna. That would be mammoth. There would be animals such as a camel, horse, which were indigenous to the area at the time, and this provided plentiful food for people that were entering this area, presumably having originated in Siberia and moved across the Bering Strait and then down into what is now the Southwest. So the classic understanding is that they would have been these big game hunters, although now archaeologists are realizing they probably also ate a whole plethora of other foods, plant food, smaller animals. The archaeological record is biased because we find the big stuff, the big bones that are left over, and not the smaller things.
As I was looking through your book, I just kept thinking over and over again, how in the world do they know? Because everybody can find pots and tools and arrowheads, but once you start talking about things like what they ate, organic matter that returns to the earth, or what they thought, you're getting into ground that seems almost impossible.
Sure. Well, that actually, when I started out my academic career, I wanted to be an evolutionary biologist, or actually going into medicine was a backup plan. But the sort of puzzle aspect of doing archaeology was just so inviting to me, and trying to figure out what people were doing so long ago based on this incomplete record of their past behavior. It really is a great intellectual challenge to figure out these kinds of details, and in many cases we have to make inferences that maybe aren't the strongest, but there are many clever, creative ways to discover things about the past.
So when people think about ancient indigenous civilizations, they often have this idea that there's a sort of unchanging, primordial, close to the earth, you know, maybe happy, maybe violent people. But you describe periods of intense cultural change that go on, you know, century after century, millennium after millennium. So when you go back to 12,000 years ago, what kind of evolution happened, and what were the drivers of cultural change?
Right. Okay. Well, that's a great question. That's my book really is focused upon, or one of the themes that comes out of this book is the idea that people in the past were really not that much different than people today. And so that means that just like today, there are lots of factors that influence how we change. Some of those factors are just the way that humans are, some of the basic human nature, and this includes violence, cooperation, you know, concerns about each other. Those are certainly important factors that would have influenced people in the past, just like today. And then to throw into the mix, of course, is the environmental context and the social context in which we live. And so the environment, of course, is constantly changing. And people respond to that in various ways according to their own interests and their own cultural precepts.
Now, you also have changes in the amount of population. During a wet period with abundant food, you're going to have population growth. Then when there's a change in climate, you've got problems.
That's right. One of the lessons that we see from the past, just like we can sort of anticipate today, is that as populations grow, they're going to do that during a time period when things are really quite pleasant and there's lots of opportunity, and people see that there's no end to the richness of the environment, and so they tend to overextend themselves and don't really anticipate so well what might happen far into the future. And something ultimately is going to change, and the environment will change, there'll be a crisis, or just the continual population growth will lead to stresses that force people to make adjustments. And that doesn't mean that people just all die off. It just means that they have to change how they interact with one another and with the environment. And that, I think, is one of the clear lessons that you see in the Pueblo and Southwest, because this is a place where, as we know today, the climate has such a tremendous impact.
Well, one of the things you talk about is because it's so dry here, there's a much greater opportunity for archaeological preservation, and so we actually can know more.
That's right. Yeah, that's one of the wonderful things about working here. I had done quite a bit of work in Central America, and one of the challenges there is that the preservation is not nearly as good, so you can't really marshal all the different sources of evidence to figure out what happened in the past. Here in the Southwest, you really can.
So what were some of the actual specific ways in which changes in climate played out, and then how do you figure out what actually happened?
Sure. Well, my specific area of expertise is in the Chacoan culture, of which was centered in Chaco Canyon, and that had influence over a vast area of the Pueblo and Southwest, both across space and through time. And one of the lessons about this particular phenomenon is that they were expanding during a time period which was quite wet in the grand scheme of southwestern paleoclimate. And they expanded to such a degree that as soon as the environment began to change, even just a little bit, it didn't have to take a huge change, but just even a small change was enough to make things extremely challenging for them. And so the way that I often describe it is that the Chacoan society built up this house of cards of great complexity, taking tremendous energy in order to feed it. And then as soon as the climate changed, then the whole thing fell apart quite rapidly. And that is something we see repeating several times in the Southwest.
What was the change in climate?
Well, what we see is that the Chacoan society began to emerge as sort of a distinctive phenomenon in the late 9th century. And this is a time period when people had already become full-time farmers. They already were living in above-ground masonry architecture. And they had invested in overproducing food, because this is one of the ways that you adapt to the instability of the Southwest, is that you make sure that you produce as much as you possibly can and store it for those years when things aren't so good.
So it's the survivalists of 1,000 years ago.
It was the survivalists of 1,000 years ago, and it makes perfect sense, because you just don't know from year to year, just as we see here in Santa Fe, you don't know from year to year what the rainfall is going to be like. So you just overproduce. Now what happens is, during a time period when things are continually good year after year after year, they're continuing to overproduce because that's what they're geared towards, but their storehouses are filling up further and further. And you have to do something with that. And what happened in the case of Chaco Canyon is they began to invest into large-scale architecture, ultimately building this really elaborate pilgrimage center that drew people from hundreds of miles around. And they continued to build this up, massive architecture, incredible investment, carrying hundreds of thousands of logs across the desert in order to build this architecture, trading with over long distances for macaws, for copper bells, for turquoise, for shell. And this continued to be elaborated until the pattern of climate improvement began to disappear. And it wasn't that phenomenal of a change. It happened around the early 1100s, and they begin to not be able to produce quite as much, and not nearly as much as they needed to sustain that same momentum. And so things quickly collapse. They just can't get the macaws anymore. They can't get all the huge log beams across the desert anymore. They can't invest in the entire phenomenon, and so it just fades away.
We're talking to John Kantner. His book is called Ancient Pueblo and Southwest. Now, without refrigeration, how did they store food?
Well, let's see. The storage, what they focused upon, is food that was easily storable. So that's going to be maize in particular, because you can dry, of course, the corn cobs, or take the corn off and store the corn. And this can actually last for many, many years. So as long as you can protect it from moisture, which is usually not a terrible problem in the Southwest to protect food from moisture, and as long as you can protect it from other vermin that might want that food, then you can keep that for quite a long period of time. So that's what people tended to store. And other foods that may not be so storable like pinyon nuts or obviously ghim or other kinds of plant foods, that's the stuff you eat right away. You keep the corn for sort of backup food.
So when we talk about the word Puebloan refers to a pueblo, refers to building, refers to architecture. This elaborate architecture, which we still see signs of in the way we build our buildings here in Santa Fe today, became so elaborate primarily because of food storage?
Well, okay, that's a good question. If we go back to when people first begin to farm, they are living in below-ground pit structures. And this makes a lot of sense in the Southwest because during the winter, those below-ground pit structures, they protect you from the cold. And, of course, during the summer, they provide insulation against the heat. But they're not so great for storing food in. You just can't keep on piling food into these big holes in the ground because then, of course, animals can get into it. It takes a lot of effort to do that. So they began to construct above-ground architecture, the masonry architecture that is famous for, that the Puebloans are famous for. And this above-ground architecture then becomes the focus of domestic life in Puebloan society. Now, in Chaco Canyon, what they do is they take the idea of this above-ground architecture and they turn it into these monumental structures that probably were not used for storage but were big just for the sake of being big. If you're going to construct a pilgrimage center, you need phenomenal monuments for people to come and experience. And so
cathedrals.
Cathedrals, exactly. So what we see as the great houses in Chaco Canyon are the equivalent of cathedrals or monuments you'll see in any pilgrimage center across the world today and in prehistory. And so that's what they're doing. They're building these huge structures. Probably they weren't fully used for storage or domestic residence. Instead, they were just built for the sake of having something huge there, and they just kept on building them until, again, the wheels came off with the minor drought that all of a sudden people weren't so interested in investing in this pilgrimage center.
Now, pilgrimage suggests a whole religious orientation. Where were the pilgrims coming from? What were they coming to? What was the religious structure?
Right, that's a good question. That is one of the focal points of my research, is trying to figure out why people would want to involve themselves in a pilgrimage center. Because, of course, as a pilgrim, you are often required to invest in the center. You bring food, you invest your labor in it. And so the question is, what do you receive in return? In the case of Chaco Canyon, it's pretty certain that people are bringing pottery, they're bringing beams, they're contributing their labor, they're probably bringing food into the canyon, but nothing really is going out in a material sense. Instead, people are going there for the religious experience. And that religious experience probably was related to the same themes that we see in Puebloan society today, and that is the clerical rituals that are so important for farmers. Keeping track of things like solstice events, equinoxes, changes in as the sun passes through the sky over the year. In an environment like the Southwest, which is arid but also can be quite cold, you have to worry about the growing season and when to plant and when to harvest. And a lot of the religious activity is going to be related to that. And Chaco Canyon, I think, really seized into that. They built all these archaeoastronomical features that were designed to observe the passage of the heavens. And
so there's some place you can stand on the solstice and the sun shines through,
right,
a
yeah.
crack.
Chaco Canyon is full of those kinds of features, and that seems to be what people tend to know the most about Chaco Canyon. There are features like the sun dagger, the alignments of the buildings, all of it, the entire landscape there, both built landscape and the actual landscape, is oriented towards this understanding of the passage of time in a cyclical fashion, which is so important for farmers.
And so people did rituals around those times, those seasons.
That's the idea, exactly. And the evidence is pretty compelling towards that interpretation.
Does some of that evidence come from observing contemporary culture, observing Indians of the last 100 years?
Sure, yeah. The ethnographic record of Puebloan society today provides us with a lot of the means for interpreting what happened in the past. And that includes the importance of the cyclical calendar, the seasonal calendar, the importance of the farming sequences. These are all things which are critical to Puebloan people historically and today. And we extend that back into the past to make the same interpretations of what happened 1,000 years ago. Now, one of the problems with this is often you have to be conscious as an archaeologist not to simply take the ethnography of, say, you know, 1845 and impose it on 900 AD. And so that's a challenge that archaeologists have, is drawing lessons from Puebloan people today, but also understanding that change happened in the past just like it happens today. And we can't just picture the Puebloan people of 1,000 years ago as being mirror copies of the Puebloan people historically in the Southwest.
We're talking to John Kantner. What were some of the basic technologies that people used, and what were some of the technological inventions and revolutions that happened over these thousands of years you're looking at?
Oh, gosh. The kinds of developments that you're going to see in that regard, a lot of it surrounds pottery, because, of course, pottery is one thing that we find in the archaeological record. We have a good understanding of how pottery changes through time. And a lot of those changes include how pottery is made in order to provide the maximum amount of storage, in order to make sure the pottery doesn't break when it's being heated, when you're cooking with it. And there's also technological changes that reflect how people want to decorate their pottery. So, for example, the earliest pottery tends to be these white wares that are painted with basic organic or mineral paints. But as time goes on, people want newer kinds of pottery. They need different looks to their pottery. And so a lot of the developments that we see on the archaeological record reflect this. So we have, for example, the use of glazewares that replace some of the earlier organic decorations on the pottery. So these are some of the technological changes that we see. But in general, Puebloan society, you don't see a tremendous amount of technological change. I mean, they had a system that worked very well for adapting to the Puebloan Southwest. They certainly experimented with irrigation, different ways of doing agriculture, and we see quite a bit of evidence of that. But generally, things worked quite well, and so there's not a tremendous amount of momentum towards technological change.
And I suppose that's one of the significant differences between that culture and our own, which is so geared toward continually changing its technology.
Well, I think that's true, and part of that has to do with the phenomenal growth of populations today and the need to constantly be changing technologies to keep up with that. But also part of it actually goes back to what I was describing in reference to the need for new looks to pottery. A lot of our technology today is not so much to make life easier or to make it easier to extract energy from the environment. A lot of it is just to have cooler, newer stuff that we can put into our living rooms. And to, I think, a significant degree, you see seeds of that even in the Puebloan prehistory 1,000 years ago, people doing these same kinds of things. They wanted something new that would distinguish them from other people in their social environment.
When you talk about Chaco Canyon, you talk about a society that for a time was really expanding. Was there what we think of as governmental control over the areas toward which into which it was expanding?
Another area of my research is focusing upon, you know, how we can look at buildings and we see big buildings and we can see pottery change, but what does that mean as far as how people interacted with one another? And I think that what you see is that there are, within any Puebloan village, there certainly are leaders, probably have some rule within the ceremonial rituals of that particular community, and they form alliances with one another, they interact with one another, but we don't see that there are anything equivalent of kings or any other kind of entity that would have widespread control over a large area of the Southwest. Instead, village autonomy or regional autonomy is one of the continuing themes, and that's actually a continuing theme in humans in general. People just don't like to give up their decision-making abilities to others, and only when forced to do so does that happen. In the Southwest, you see the same thing.
Now, it's interesting because one of the themes in your book, when you talk about leadership, is decision-making. What kind of decisions needed to be made?
Well, the kinds of decisions that need to be made are generally regarding, of course, the farming cycle. You need to know when to plant, you need to know when to harvest. The most successful farming takes place when people cooperate in that regard. And so some kind of collaborative decision-making is going to, of course, benefit farmers in that way. You also, of course, have to deal with the fact that there are lots of other people in your social environment. And so you need to figure out how to interact with the village next door. You need to figure out how you're going to get, say, volcanic glass from some long distance away, because that's the best kind of tool. And so there's decision making that has to be done on that scale. And that's, I think, where you see some of these early leaders within these villages taking some authority. They both have some influence over what takes place within the community as far as the farming cycle, but they also are responsible in various ways of trying to establish relationships to get the goodies from far away.
We're talking to John Cantner. There were periods of real violence and conflict, and I was wondering the Puebloan Southwest is a big place, lots of communities, lots of groups. Did they speak the same language? Were they the same ethnicity, whatever that means in that context?
Sure. Well, the answer to the last two questions, as far as the same ethnicity and the same language, is no. They weren't the same ethnic groups. They weren't the same. They didn't have the same languages. And we know this because we can see today that there are different languages that Puebloan people speak, that and the distinctions between them have great time depth in the Southwest. So a lot of the language differences must have happened a long time ago. And
Even though they have the same roots in Siberia, presumably.
Right, right. And, well, you can make the same argument going all the way back to, say, Africa, that we all have the same roots in Africa, but
obviously they're
quite distinct. And that, you know, I would argue, of course, is part of human nature, is that we tend to distinguish ourselves from one another in the complex social environments in which humans exist.
Or even simple environments,
like an
elementary school.
That's right, exactly. We tend to form our little cliques, and you can see it from the small scale of human society to the largest scales. And that's certainly the case in the Southwest. And so there's going to be different groups all over the place. We tend to refer to them as the Puebloan groups because they do share some cultural traits. They live in above ground architecture. They're farmers. They, just like all farmers, they pay attention to the passage of the sun. So there's a lot of cultural traits that they share, but of course they
similarity in their art.
And there's some similarity in their art as well, but there also, you will see differences in pottery across the Southwest, the Puebloan Southwest, and as well as rock art. So there's similarities and differences just as you see for all humans. They're all quite distinct. That doesn't mean necessarily that they're warring with one another all the time or that there's this continual theme of violence. Certainly in the last decade or so, that's been a major theme in what the press picks up about the Puebloan Southwest, because there's been a few books that have been published about warfare in the Southwest. There have been a few books that were published about cannibalism in the Southwest. But in essence, people in the Puebloan Southwest were no different than, say, you know, people in Europe or people in South Africa or people in Australia at any given moment in time.
So what were the types of events, do you think, that led to conflicts when there were conflicts?
Well, same thing that you'd see today. So sometimes it's over food, but more often than not, it's simply over disagreements between groups, long-standing feuds between neighboring villages. Runs the gamut of the same things we see today. In various points in time, for example, after the collapse of Chaco Canyon, there's a political vacuum that leads to a lot of conflict, some of which is violent. And that's simply as political and social relationships are being sort of renegotiated after that 800-pound gorilla that some archaeologists consider Chaco to be. After that disappeared, then people were, okay, well, what do we do now? Who's going to be in charge now? So we see conflict as those negotiations take place, and that includes warfare. Now, at other times, some of the conflict is related to environmental crisis and people trying to find food. And we see that as well in the Puebloan Southwest, just like we see it anywhere else in the world.
I would think that the study of anthropology and archaeology inevitably has biases of the student and biases of the time built into it. And looking back, say, 100 years or to the roots of early archaeology and anthropology, it's very easy to see those biases, but it's very hard to see one's own in one's own time. How do you deal with that? How do you think about it?
Right. That's a problem that, of course, historians have, archaeologists have. Anybody who looks at the past inevitably has to interpret the past through the lenses of the present. We have no way to independently go back and figure out exactly what was taking place. And even if we were, even if people observe the world around them today, they interpret it through the lens of their own experience. So for archaeologists, this is historically, you can see this pattern. You can see that sometimes when America's is engaged in lots of violent interactions, then we tend to emphasize violent interactions in the past. When American culture is focused upon cooperation and peace, then often that's the way that we interpret things in the past. And that's a challenge for archaeologists, because we like to try as much as possible to have some objective understanding of the, of what happened. And and so insofar as that's possible, we do that through the marshaling of as much evidence as possible. And I think, most importantly, a real understanding of how your own biases are being brought to bear upon your interpretations of the past. And I think that that sort of reflexive understanding of your position as a researcher, and understanding what it is that you want to see about the past, and using that to judge your interpretations, I think, is an important part of being a scholar.
I would think also, I mean, a huge part of anthropology is studying gender roles. What was the role of men and women in any time? Are there many women archaeologists, anthropologists looking at this time and place?
Sure, absolutely. And there have been many books that have been published on gender in the Pueblo and Southwest. And archaeologically, again, that's difficult to identify gender roles. You know, one way that we tend to do that is to look at burials or burial context, because that's when you can really associate a sex of a buried individual with the material remains that are found with them. And so there have been a number of studies that have focused upon that. Many of the themes of research that archaeologists have focused on is figuring out, for example, were past societies in the Southwest, were they matrilineal, were they patrilineal? We know today, for example, that many Pueblan groups are matrilineal, and when did that happen? Is that, how far back in time does that go? And
those, do we know?
Well, that's difficult to determine. There are various studies that have focused, for example, on burials that show that females in Pueblan society in the not-so-distant past, that they have the same kinds of burial goods found with them as males have with them. Sometimes even richer burials are female burials. And so that suggests that perhaps matrilineal society in the Pueblo and Southwest goes back a considerable ways. And so I think there's pretty compelling evidence towards that. When we get further and further into the past, and as the evidence gets scantier and scantier, then the interpretations get harder to make.
Now, you spoke a while ago about the fascination of putting together the pieces of a puzzle, and that's part of what fascinates archaeologists. And I can imagine that, although, you know, I think it must be really a calling to want to do that. But what does the study of archaeology bring to the general reader, to the general population? I would think we have so much to learn from our past, although it's not clear that we would ever actually absorb the lessons in any real way.
That's a good point. One of the compelling things about being an archaeologist is that you have access to a vast database of human behavior. It's not a complete database, but we have, you know, all the way from the formation of the very first humans as a species, all the way into up to today, and we have access to, you know, societies from, you know, across every continent in the world. So we really, I think, more so than almost any other discipline, have some idea about what humans are like. At least we should have that kind of idea, because we have such a vast database. And that's one of the main interests that I have in archaeology. As an anthropologist, you know, I'm interested in human nature. I'm interested in what it is that humans do. I'm interested in why humans change. I'm interested in the problems that humans experience. And we can look at that in every single continent and every single time period to figure out how people have responded to opportunity, to crisis, to dealing with one another.
Can you funnel that to the people in Congress?
Yeah, actually, archaeologists have been pretty bad about that, and I think anthropologists in general, is that we generate these lessons from the past, but we aren't so good at disseminating that information, and that actually was one of the motivations for writing this book, is that, you know, in this book I'm making this major argument that, you know, there are major lessons from the past that we should and can learn. And trying to get that to policymakers, that is more of a challenge for archaeologists. Our major role in policymaking is the preservation of cultural patrimony. We try to, of course, help to enact laws that preserve archaeological resources under the argument that, of course, that this can provide us information about the past that is useful for today. We've never been quite so good at actually developing those arguments in a way which is consumable by policymakers. So I think it's a challenge for our discipline, and anthropology in general has that challenge.
But your book is a step in that direction.
It is, because I've moved out of my myopic studies on this one particular time period in a very small part of the world and tried to extend it to sort of broader lessons about humanity.
The book is called Ancient Puebloan Southwest by John Cantner. John Cantner is Vice President of the School for Advanced Research, and the book is published by Cambridge University Press. And thanks for being with us. I'd like now to welcome Tim Gallego. He is a member of the Oglala Lakota tribe and an award-winning journalist. He's the author of several books, the latest of which is Children Left Behind, The Dark Legacy of Indian Mission Boarding Schools. It's published by Clear Light Books. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Yeah, thank you.
It's great to have you here. The Indian boarding schools are a heartbreaking and terrible story that probably our listeners have heard some things about over the years. But I was talking to somebody yesterday who said, oh, wasn't that the 19th century? No, this is very much of a 20th century phenomenon.
Yeah, I find that there's a lot of ignorance, you know, in America about what happened for almost 100 years. So, in fact, I was a third generation of my family, my grandmother, my mother and father, and then me. They all went to an Indian mission boarding school.
Now, something I was wondering, I mean, in the early days of the boarding schools, government officials would come in, take children against their parents' will, ship them off to these boarding schools for 9 months a year. In the second and third generation, did parents send their children more willingly?
Well, in my case, we were just coming out of the Great Depression. And it was hard to make a living out on the reservation, as it still is today. And my parents, even though they had experience boarding school, felt that three meals a day and a roof over my head was something that was beneficial for me and my brothers and sisters. So we went. We were sent. We didn't want to go, but we were sent anyhow.
And once you got there, it was not a happy place.
Well, it was very sad to be torn from your family to begin with, and I think that's the first things that most of us experienced, being taken away from a totally different environment in our homes, you know, where my family spoke the Lakota language, and all of a sudden being put into an institution, sleeping in barracks-type dormitories, marching to everything that happened. We marched to church, we marched to the dining room, went to school half a day, and we were literally slave laborers. We worked for the mission in the afternoons. And I think the whole experience of being that disconnect that you have, your teachers were your grandparents, your grandparents traditionally. You learned the culture and your traditions from them. And when that tie was severed, it caused a lot of problems within the child, and it became even more pointed as that child grew up and got older and began to have very little self-esteem and felt that there was something wrong with themselves, would go home and couldn't speak to their grandparents because they didn't know the language anymore.
And they were forbidden very strongly with terrible punishments if they spoke so much as a word of their language.
Oh, I've witnessed many of the punishments. One of the favorites was to bite down on a rubber band, and the priest, the Jesuit priest, would stretch it as far as he could while he clamped it in your teeth and then snap it back in your face. So that was pretty effective.
Tim Gallego has written this book, Children Left Behind, and he's going to be speaking this Sunday here in Santa Fe from 2 to 4 at the Museum of Indian Arts and Culture on Camino Lejo. And also on Saturday, he's going to be in Albuquerque at the Indian Pueblo Culture Center from 2 to 4 as well. This is a story of church and state working together.
Yes.
These were mission boarding schools, so it was all about, in your case, nuns and priests working in hand with, what, Bureau of Indian Affairs officials to get you guys there?
Yes. As a matter of fact, they had two types of boarding schools. They had the Bureau of Indian Affairs boarding schools, and I think Santa Fe, that was a BIA boarding school. They had one in Phoenix. They had a big one in Albuquerque. But they were run by the Bureau of Indian Affairs, and they were just as bad, if not worse, than the Indian mission boarding schools. And it wasn't just the Catholic. We had Methodists and Mormons and other denominations that ran the boarding schools. It was sort of like on our reservation, it was divided up like a piece of pie by the federal government, and different denominations were given permission to set up schools and bring children in to different religions.
It's extraordinary, and the motto was "Kill the Indian to save the child."
That's right.
One of the things that you bring out in this book is the extent to which the legacy of this stuff. I mean, children being brutalized by these nuns and priests and teachers that you had in their school, to the point of really torture in some cases, and certainly tremendous violence, that had some legacies. I mean, what were some of the dark legacies of that when these students grew up?
Well, I guess if I could look at it from a personal point of view, My sister was about 9 years old, and she was assaulted by a staff member at Holy Rosary Indian Mission.
She was raped by a staff member.
Yes, and when they grew up, I had a meeting with several girls that were classmates of my sister, and they had all been assaulted by the same man, and he'd been there for 10 or 15 years. And so there's no telling how many young girls, usually 8 or 9 years old, that he assaulted during all of those years. And the girls I talked to were probably in their 30s or 40s at that time. They wanted me to hear their story because I was a journalist and I was a member of the tribe and I'd gone to school there with them. And a lot of them had become alcoholics, drug addicts, prostitutes, you name it. I mean, they were not... They didn't adjust to life after Holy Rosary. A lot of the boys grew up that way, too. I mean, a lot of the boys were assaulted by priests also.
And I think the another point you bring out is that even for students who didn't go to boarding school, they had some relative who did. And so the legacy of boarding schools basically hits everybody in Indian country.
I hear it all the time. I talk to young people today. Talked to some last night in Albuquerque, as a matter of fact, that were like in their early 20s. They feel the impact of it because their grandfather or their father or their grandmother went to a boarding school. And they have felt the consequences of it, even as far as the language goes, because their parents lost their ability to speak the language and therefore never pass it on to the children. So
there's one horrifying example of a teacher in the school, I believe the school that you went to, who learned the Lakota language, was very diligent about learning it, and still brutally punished the students who were speaking it.
Well, he's a gentleman that one day I was speaking at South Dakota State University, and someone stood up and asked me the question, "What would you do if Father Bride was here in the room?" I said, "Well, I probably wouldn't speak to him because I remember some of the horrific things he did to us, and now he's written a book on Indian psychology from his point of view. And he learned the Lakota language and beat us for speaking our own language." So it was the real
dichotomy
there.
It's extraordinary. I mean, your book is very much about healing. You and a number of other people at a certain point really took it upon yourselves to bring an end to the boarding school system.
I think when I first started to write about it, it upset the boarding school, especially the Catholic Church, very badly. They felt I was hurting their ability to solicit monies for the schools. They raised millions of dollars for some of those Indian schools up there, and you know, and we saw very few of the benefits of all that money. A lot of that money was spent to buy land, good rich farmland in Nebraska that was purchased by the Holy Rosary Indian Mission Society. And
for what purpose?
To increase the wealth of the church.
Of the Catholic Church.
And a lot of the funds that came into the church actually for Indian children was sent back to the main diocese in Boston and other places. So we got very little benefit. In fact, we worked during our keep there. So.
Now, you published a book of poetry, and this book, Children Left Behind, is a expansion of it. Your
yes.
first book came out in the late 70s called Aboriginal Sin.
Right.
And it caused such a stir that the priests and officials of the school that you'd gone to tried to erase the fact that you even went to that school from the records.
Well, I felt like I was living in the Soviet Union for a while.
They were airbrushing you out of the yearbook and
stuff. I was out of the yearbooks. The pictures were all cut up. And I was a non-person. I didn't exist. I never did get an education is what it amounted to.
And this is about a book of poetry.
A book of poetry, right. I mentioned names, and I named names in the book of poetry also, and it upset the church quite a bit.
And to add insult to injury, they asked you to write a fundraising letter for them.
They asked me to write a letter saying that things had changed, that it wasn't that way anymore.
Ay, ay, ay. It's really quite extraordinary. As you say, even though things have now changed in the boarding schools, the legacy of them is horrific, and I'm wondering that in the process of restoration of your spirit and the spirit of so many people who went there, what has been regained and what is hard to regain? I mean, once a language is lost, can the language be restored? What can be restored?
Well, believe it or not, even Holy Rosary Indian Mission has now brought Elder Lakota people on staff to teach the language. So they've done a total about face. So a lot of the kids that would have been denied the language are learning it now. And a lot of us that had lost a good part of it are studying it again on our own. You know, there's a lot of Indian colleges now, like the Oglala Lakota College on the Pioneer Reservation, and language is one of their main courses. So.
And what about the young people? What about kids who are now 2, 3, 4, 7 years old? Are they learning Lakota?
It's spoken in the homes now. So, yeah, it's not lost amongst us. We're fairly isolated out on the Pioneer Reservation, so a lot of the people retain the language, so... you know, and there's a lot of places in Oklahoma, for one, and that the tribes have almost totally lost their languages. So.
Now, you became a journalist. You won some very prestigious fellowships. You went on to have a successful career as a journalist, as a writer. What allowed you to keep going and pursue that dream when other people were devolving into alcohol and violence and other forms of real expression of pain?
Well, I think you named it right off the top, writing. By sitting down, I wrote that first book of poetry. I started when I was about 17 years old, and I was on a ship on my way to Korea, and laying in my bunk, I started writing poems because I was just thinking about some of my days at Holy Rosary Mission, and I kept on writing them over the years until one day I sent them to a Kauai Indian man named Rupert Costo, and he was a publisher of the Indian Historian Press in San Francisco. And he had been to a boarding school, and he said he started reading those poems, and he said he got goosebumps because it brought back everything to himself, and he published that small little book of poetry. So it was really a catharsis for me to write about those things and then be able to look at what I wrote, and relive them, analyze them, and I think that's what pulled me through. And as a matter of fact, I just went to a movie called The Freedom Writers, and I think that's a very good movie that a lot of teachers should take their students to see, especially the minority students. Because in writing, a lot of these kids who had witnessed murders and everything else while growing up in the ghettos, they brought a lot of their feelings to the surface by writing about it.
And this is a movie that's out now?
Just came out, right.
The Freedom Writers.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's something to look for. Your daughter did the illustrations of the book.
Yes. Denise went to school here in Santa Fe. She's a graduate of IAIA, and she's an accomplished artist and a good writer, and I'm really proud of her.
So where are people at right now? Do students still, I mean, you say these boarding schools have changed, but are parents still sending their children to boarding school?
Well, for the most part, boarding schools have been eliminated, at least, you know, in the church denominations. BIA still has one or two boarding schools, but for the most part, like Holy Rosary, where I went to school, the kids are still going to school there, but they get bused home every night, so they don't live there in the environment that I did. That was one of the major changes that took place.
What's the next step for healing for Indian people, and specifically where you come from?
You know, I would like to see the church come out of denial. I sat down with the superintendent and the principal of Holy Rosary Red Cloud Indian School now about a year and a half ago, and we had a nice talk, but they will not admit any of the things that happened. And I had to tell them, I said, you know, I could bring 30 or 40 kids that I grew up with right here, right now. And they said, well, we can bring 30 or 40 kids that really loved it here. And they probably could. You know, we all see things through our own eyes. And some kids just didn't witness the things that were happening around them. I guess I was more sensitive to it because I was writing about it.
Well, Tim Gallego, thank you so much for writing this book and for being with us here on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.
I enjoyed it much.
Children Left Behind, The Dark Legacy of Indian Mission Boarding Schools by Tim Gallego is published by Clear Light Books here in Santa Fe.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. You can email me at radiocafe@ksfr.org or leave a message at 428-1528. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and after that, jazz.